This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz. Our guest tonight is Kevin Haig. Kevin Haig is a Green MP and he's currently standing for the co-leadership of the Green Party, and there's a big contest going on here. But we're here to talk to him about his history, his life and stuff, and we're going to have a bit of a special show with him tonight, and we're going to talk about that for the full time, because I don't think either of us have had... we're just going to talk to Kevin about that. So we shall skip past our usual pieces and talk to Kevin directly. Welcome to our show.
Great to be here, Shane.
And I was just wondering, you were born... You weren't born in New Zealand, were you?
No, I was born in England, in a place called Farnborough, which some people know because it's the air show, yes.
And that's a really famous air show. And what brought you to New Zealand?
Well, it's a pretty common story for immigrants the world around. My parents were working class people who wanted a better life particularly for us, their kids. So they looked at their circumstances in England and concluded that if they stayed, they would probably never own a home, and we, their kids, would probably never have the opportunity to go to university or tertiary training of any sort. And so they thought, well, New Zealand is a place where those opportunities would be available, and actually that's how it did turn out.
And so what was it? Was it a big transition for you coming from England to New Zealand? And what was that like? You were a teenager?
I was 13, yeah. It was a big culture shock. You know, it was very different. So I went to my first day of school at Hamilton Boys High School wearing my English school uniform, which consisted of long pants, you know, shirt and tie, blazer. And other boys noticed that I was maybe a little bit different from them and let me know, you know.
Pretty much straight away, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. And so Hamilton's obviously quite different from Farnborough.
Yeah.
And it's the middle of the North Island. It's farming country. And it was a massive culture shock. And what were your first impressions of New Zealand? I mean, apart from... You know, maybe feeling very uncomfortable, or did you recognise some bits, and was it just a bit strange?
It's a long time ago now, so 1973. The things that I remember are mostly physical things. So, looking at houses, and houses being single story and having corrugated iron on the roof, things that you really don't see very much in England at all. And those physical differences were really apparent. And I guess New Zealand kids tended to be more physically active than the English kids that I've been spending time with. So, yeah, I mean, a few differences like that. Those are the only things that really make the difference, apart from, of course, the natural environment. You know, the natural environment in England is so... So modified by human impact over centuries, and that's a very different situation to much of the natural environment still in New Zealand.
And so, were you happy at school, or was that something just happened?
They weren't the happiest days of my life, I was sometimes happy. So. There were periods when I was subject to bullying or not enjoying life at all. It was pretty miserable from time to time. And as a gay man, I guess, I was not aware of that at the time, but in retrospect, I know that that was one of the issues that, that I was, I guess, mentally and emotionally navigating for my for myself, and that was pretty difficult in that environment. But on the other hand, I did make friends who've stayed my friends, you know, for the whole of my life. And, you know, so there were good times too.
So you went off then to university, and what did you study? You studied some interesting subjects, which I didn't immediately pick up on.
Well, my first degree was in maths and geophysics. So geophysics is the physics of, I guess, earthquakes and tectonic plates, but also oceanic physics and atmospheric physics, you know, which are the building blocks now of climate science. I first read about climate change in, I think, 1972 in a sort of popular science book by Isaac Asimov. And at the time that I was studying those subjects at university, I wasn't thinking, I'm going to be a climate scientist. But actually, it turns out that it's pretty useful to have that basic science knowledge when it comes to dealing with climate change now at a political level.
So a lot of people know that, I mean, maybe not many people know, did you have a very strong activist background? Was that something that started at university, or was that something that, you know, or did that happen afterwards? Or
yeah,
was there a moment that you remember?
It's a bit murky to me because I know that when I was at school in England, so when I was 11 or 12, I started an anti-pollution club at my school. You know, I can't remember what on earth we did, but we had a club. And so in retrospect, I'm thinking, well, I must already have had those political thoughts. And this is a weird story, but a few years ago, my cousin in England shared with me on Facebook a recording that he'd found on an old reel-to-reel tape in the attic, you know, at his mother's place, in my auntie's place. And the reel-to-reel is of my grandfather talking to me at, I think I must have been aged 4, maybe 5. And at one point in the conversation, my granddad moves from talking about zoo animals and a typical 4 or 5 year old concerns to what do you think you might be when you grow up? And I think you might end up being a politician. And I think, how on earth, you know, how on earth was that connection made?
That's incredible.
Yeah. So, I wasn't thinking from all the time since I was 4 or 5, I'm going to be a politician. But it has always been a thing for me that if I see something that needs doing, I don't get how you can live with yourself and allow an injustice to continue. So I've been sort of always motivated to take action on some things. So at Hamilton Boys High, I thought it was crazy that boys were stratified according to their age. You know, that was kind of an unnatural way of organizing big groups of people. So I lobbied for and secured a house system for the school. And then moving on to university, I guess my first year was very very academically oriented because I was very scared I would fail, of course, as first years tend to be. And then in the second year I was a bit more relaxed and started to become involved in political issues. And actually my first political party involvement was as a member of the Young Nationals, which I consider most of my life since that time to be an atonement for
all of these youthful dalliances which you regret later on.
Yeah, well, so the thing for me was I saw the National Party as being a party of individual liberty and freedom and. That was very important to me at the time. And so for probably about 3 months, I was a member of their party, and including voting National in 1978. And then pretty quickly, I came to realize that actually those rights were pretty meaningless if everybody was starting from different places, and that actually kind of creating justice in the first place was the only way that you could actually truly create individual freedom in a just way across a society.
So moving on from university, so you graduated from university, and what happened then? What did you do straight after university? You came out, you had a new degree in your hand.
Yeah. Well, I did not become a scientist. So the very first thing I did, the very first job I had was as a research officer for the Auckland team of detached youth workers, who were a team of social workers working with young people, street kids and other young people who were marginalised in Auckland. And I did that for probably, I don't know, maybe 4 months or something. And what I quickly realised is that actually while there was a lot I could add to the work of these social workers, they really didn't see what I could add. So they had no perceived need of a research officer. So I was generating research that no one was using. And so I went and got a job for Whitkells, actually, in the educational books division, which sold textbooks, largely textbooks and library books to schools, you know, up and down the country. And I did that for a little while, managing sales reps and that operation across the country, and taking on some other bits of Whitkell's operation. So at the time that I left in 84, I guess, I was sort of managing the book-selling operations for the upper half of the North Island, with the exception of the Auckland retail stores. So everything else was in my domain. And it was a great education in the business world, but also a great way of ensuring that the kinds of books that Whitkells was stocking, at least at that time, reflected, you know, ideas of social justice. I don't know if anyone ever twigged to that, but and certainly the books that we were selling into schools, you know, that probably made a bit of a difference for a lot of kids.
Were you politically active then?
Yeah, I was, because that was coming out of my time in 1981 in the anti-apartheid movement. In 79, 80, I'd become involved in student politics, and then move from that into the anti-apartheid movement. So 1981, of course, was that massive watershed moment for New Zealand as a society, where, I mean, this is why it's so completely unbelievable that John Key can't remember which side of that argument he was on. Everybody knew which side they were on. And in a context that was, in fact, so life-changing for so many New Zealanders that it's inconceivable that someone couldn't remember. And certainly I got involved in late 1980, really, in the planning for the 81 campaign, and was part of, I guess, a core group of people in Auckland that was planning the demonstrations. And as we moved from, I guess, 10 or 15 of us gathered together in a room meeting every week and trying to figure out how we would grow a movement, to a hall literally full twice a week planning the demonstrations, and then demonstrations that went from perhaps, you know, I think when the rugby union announced the tour, we had a picket of maybe 20 people outside their offices. But we took that during the course of their tour through to, I think, on the evening of September the 11th, 1981. So that's the night before the final test match in Auckland. We had 200,000 people in Queen Street protesting against apartheid. And so that was an enormous growth in a popular movement. And I know people say it was, a real polarizing effect in New Zealand society. I'm sure that's true, but it was a growing up and a maturing of New Zealand society as well. And we created circumstances where people had to make a stand. You had to decide whether you were for or against apartheid.
What was it that in I mean, I know, like in Ireland, we had our campaigns against apartheid as well. But what was it? Why was it so seminal in New Zealand? What nerve was it tapping? Because obviously, there's something about, there's some reflection of the problems in apartheid South Africa that was being played out in New Zealand. So, if, for it to have such an effect on so many people, what was it? What was that connection?
Well, the big answer is rugby. You know that. So rugby as our national sport, you know, heavily tied up in our national identity, and the same for at least white South Africans. You know, rugby was their national sport as well. And that history of many decades of contest in rugby between these two nations as being the pinnacle of rugby contest for them. So a bond between the two countries forged in rugby over a lot of time. And New Zealand had just been such an outlier internationally in the sports boycott of South Africa. You know, the sports boycott was well established, but because of the importance of rugby and of that contest, New Zealand had continued to hold out. Even in the face of, you know, the boycott of the Montreal Olympics, because New Zealand was participating, you know, that was a boycott aimed at our country, and so the movement that we were fostering was one that turned our national identity on its head. We said, this is actually the wrong national identity. We don't want to be known as the last country in the world prepared to play sport with South Africa as if apartheid didn't matter. And that change that we were seeking was so tied up with justice and deep values, I guess, about deep ethics that we expect every person to share, that we were successful in mobilising New Zealanders to take a stand.
One of the things I'm kind of interested in is that South Africa is, you know, white colonists going into a country and suppressing the indigenous population. Same thing happened here. Is that where that tension? Because there's obviously some sort of, it wasn't just the rugby, it wasn't just a sport. There was something else going on at play here. And is that still something that people are uncomfortable talking about?
I'm hesitant in answering the question because the shared colonial history was certainly one of the strands into the New Zealand anti-apartheid movement. So we had the in the 70s, you know, the we were building on the No Māoris, No Tour kind of slogan, which was because, of course, South Africa had previously required that New Zealand teams not include any Māori players in the teams that they sent to South Africa. And then because that was unacceptable to, or became unacceptable to New Zealand, I guess, reflecting a changing dynamic between Māori and Pākehā in New Zealand, the compromise solution was that Māori players would go to South Africa but would be honorarily white for the purpose of the tour. And, you know, weirdly, it turned out that was kind of demeaning. And so that really, really lasted just one tour. And then actually the Māori players who were subject to that were so uncomfortable by that experience that came back actually as anti-apartheid activists, really. So I know that was part of the input into the anti-apartheid movement in 81, but it had, and I guess you could say that the reason that rugby was important in national identity in both countries was because of that shared colonial past as well. So a couple of strands coming together there.
200,000 people on the streets in Auckland. Is there anything that would possibly get that many people on streets now?
I don't know is the answer. Nothing so far. But what that experience tells me is that it's possible. It tells me that we can go from 20 people on a picket and within 6 months have 200,000. That it is possible to awaken some kind of deep sense in New Zealanders that motivates them to move from passivity to action. And climate change may be the thing.
You know, it doesn't tend to affect rugby, though.
Well, the coastal grounds, of course. So it doesn't have that same national identity aspect to it. But, you know, there are still the same deep ethical duties that could be awakened. And I'm thinking particularly about what is our duty to our kids and their kids? What's our duty to those future generations? What's our duty to the Pacific, our neighbours in the Pacific? And I suspect that when we crack the formula of making the connection for New Zealanders between climate change and their lives and their sense of duty to those future generations in particular, that actually they're going to be very angry about this government that we've got now that's presided over an unprecedented increase in our carbon emissions, and despite the promise that we made to decrease them.
That's an interesting distinction you made there, because you said their lives and their sense of duty to their lifetime, because in some cases, I know people that are saying climate change is going to be fantastic, you're going to be able to grow grapes in Dunedin. So the connection to their particular lives is perhaps not that helpful, but certainly that sense of duty.
Yeah, yeah. I guess if we were to try and sort of boil down that sense of duty a bit further, it's what's the relationship between me as an individual and the collective, being part of a society? Because any one of us in New Zealand could probably construct a life that is a bit insulated from climate change, but the world cannot. The world cannot insulate itself from climate change. The consequences of the climate change that we have already locked in are going to be catastrophic for many. And I think that New Zealanders, if we can find the key that will unlock that relationship between each of us as individuals and our responsibility to each other and to future generations, that is what will get the 200,000 on Queen Street again.
But we have a problem because we have a society that treats everyone as a consumer. So we're not we're consumers. We're engaging at an economic level. I'm not a member of the library. I'm a patron or I'm a customer. And even see that at university levels, you know, your customers and people, you know, there's a financial exchange there. So we've been very insidiously being caught up in an economic and political model which says we're consumers of society or consumers of the state, that we're not participants, we're not equal, we're not citizens. You don't hear the word citizen being used, you hear the word consumer being used. How do you start re-engaging people back with society and actually re-empower people? Because that's the whole, I think I would argue, the whole one of the main forces of neoliberalism is to disempower people from engagement in the state and in their lives.
Yeah, I agree very strongly with the premises of your question. One of the slogans of the Occupy movement that I really loved was citizen, not consumer. You know, that sense of engagement and ownership of government, I think, is an essential component of making change. Not only around climate change, but around a whole lot of issues. So I've been saying we have the relationship wrong between the economy, environment, and society. We have a situation where the environment is constructed as the raw materials or the waste disposal for the economy, and and people are consumers or the labour input into the firm. And that treats the economy as the endpoint. It says the economy is some kind of immutable force of nature that the environment and society need to serve. Well, that's 100% wrong. You know, we made the economy. It's not something that can't be changed. We made it to do a particular set of things, largely to make a small proportion of society richer, at the expense of everyone else and the natural world. Well, we can make it do different things. And actually what we need to do is we need to start with our environmental and our social goals and then recognize the economy as being the set of tools that we use to achieve those. And so there's a process of re-engagement there that's required. And so we need to be asking the question, what is government for anyway? You know, that was Bill McKibben's question in his book Deep Economy about the economy. What's the economy for anyway? Terrific question that really got me thinking about this. And so when we think about what the government is for, it is about achieving our environmental and our social goals, sustainable relationship with the environment, a just society where everybody's needs are met. Those are, I think, pretty fundamental to what government is for. And our economy very clearly is not meeting those. And yet I would guess that if we went out into the octagon and asked people, well, do you agree with those as goals? The vast majority of people would say that they agree. So achieving consensus on some goals and then working with citizens to understand their agency, you know, their power as a collective, to change that relationship between the economy and those goals is, I think, you know, pretty high on my list of what we need to try and do as a society.
Should businesses maximise profit?
Well, yeah, I guess. I'm kind of okay with businesses as profit maximisers. That's what they are trying to do. But if that is the model that they use, and of course there are some businesses that don't have that as their model, you know, so some of the social enterprise models, for example, different, and I think we want to support those also. But if we're going to have businesses that are profit maximizers, what that then requires is a government that is highly interventionist in ensuring those environmental and social goals are met and are not compromised by that profit maximisation. Because what we have now is essentially unfettered profit maximisation. And what that means is if I'm a business, I'm setting out to maximise my profit. The way I do that is minimising my cost. And that means spending the least that I possibly can on labour and the least that I possibly can on raw materials and waste disposal. Okay, so profit maximisation in an unregulated or largely unregulated setting leads to environmental degradation and massive inequality and exploitation of working people.
So people on the opposite side of your political spectrum would different side would say, and the right wing always says that red tape kills jobs. You know, that's their mantra. How do you to respond to that argument? Well, talking point.
Well, I live in Greymouth, and from my kitchen window, I look out to the Paparoa Ranges where the Pike River mine was, and I've led a series of attacks on the government, first of all, that are based on the government of the 1990s, largely, on Bill Birch, Max Bradford, leading deregulation of the energy sector and of the labour market, including occupational health and safety. That led pretty directly, in my opinion, to the death of 29 men in the Pike River mine. So deregulation actually kills people. I draw parallels there between that deregulation and other disasters of deregulation that have affected and blighted the lives of many. So it's a pretty direct effect in the case of occupational health and safety. But think about the deregulation of the financial sector that led to the collapse of those finance companies, losing the retirement savings of so many New Zealanders and others around the world. Deregulation of the building industry that led to the Leakey Homes disaster in this country actually, you know, has had an enormous impact on so many people's lives. You know, so deregulation has been the far greater disaster, in my view.
But how do you respond to people that argue that the market needs to be pure?
Well, I typically go I mean, what I actually do when I encounter that argument is I say, well, let's go back to Adam Smith's Conditions for Competition, you know, from 1776, and let's see if we can find a market that meets those conditions, because there isn't one. You know, there is not a pure market, and the reality is that probably you could maybe find actually the Otago farmers market. You could just about apply his conditions to the supply of bread or cabbages, but that's about its limit. And yet we try and apply the invisible hand theory in so many other areas of the economy and actually wider society in the complete absence of those conditions. Almost no market has the, you know, many buyers and sellers. Almost no market has the no barriers to entry to the market. Almost no market has perfect information.
How is it that this paradigm of thinking about the economy or economics have been allowed to flourish, you know, without, you know, significant challenge? And how is it so dominant? I mean, you know, when it's clearly has failed to explain. I mean, economists couldn't predict the last global financial crisis. In fact, they've never been able to predict any crises. How is it that it is so dominant? Why is it so popular? Why does it dominate our conversations?
Well, look, this is a personal theory of mine, but I almost remember the point in 1984, I think it would be, when the share market news moved from being a small item, you know, that occasionally was featured on the TV news and buried deep in the bulletin, to becoming the first thing that the TV news covered every night, as if that was the most important thing in the news for New Zealanders. And there was no accident. I mean, I'm a massive fan of Alistair Barry's documentary work, and for listeners who haven't seen his documentaries, go and see them. You know, the Hot Air is the most recent one on climate change.
And available in New Zealand on air?
Yeah, they are. And before that, it was The Hollow Men. And the one that I personally find the most striking is Someone Else's Country, which documents that period in New Zealand politics, the rise to power of that 1984 to 87 Labour government and the years through to the early 90s. And what that showed was it was no accident. That series of neoliberal reforms in New Zealand was absolutely no accident, and it showed who the players were in planning that. And it was big business, Roger Douglas, a couple of other politicians, and some of the figures in the Reserve Bank. You know, that they were planning that revolution in New Zealand society, not just the New Zealand economy. And you look at the Labour Party of that time, and it was, other than that cabal around Roger Douglas, was economically illiterate and unable to resist that revolutionary change that Douglas then drove through the Labour Party and the Labour government. And, you know, Naomi Klein in her Shock Doctrine book has really documented that, you know, this wasn't an isolated case. That actually this is modus operandi for the neoliberal revolution, which is create a crisis, exploit it to the maximum. You know, the crisis that we faced had some genuine elements, you know, that there were ways in which Muldoon had been operating in the New Zealand economy that were not sustainable. But it also contained many manufactured elements. And that same approach has continued through to the present day. You know, I have ACC as one of my portfolios, you know, accident compensation. And National's attempt to privatise ACC involved Nick Smith in 2009, after his government had just come to power, talking about ACC being in financial crisis at a time when it had $20 billion worth of reserves and an operating surplus. You know, well, you know, that's a funny kind of financial crisis, actually.
Talking about revolutionary change, we skipped over how you got from selling books at Wickles to being chief executive of a district health board and then on to being a Green MP. So yeah. First half of that first, please.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, I'm not a person that plans a career, you know. So I know there are people who say, I always wanted to be such and such, and have planned a career that's kind of a stepwise rational progression. I'm always a person who has tried to maximize opportunities in terms of career development, but also follow my heart in terms of what I think, you know, follow my heart or my conscience about what I should be doing. And what that's meant is, so I went from anti-apartheid movement, working for Wickles, and then working for the anti-apartheid movement again, because we needed to stop the All Blacks going to South Africa. And so I worked full time on that campaign, developed the strategy, learned from what didn't really work in 81, and developed a strategy that worked. We stopped the All Blacks going to South Africa. And then from that, also involved, of course, in homosexual law reform as a gay man. That was personally important to me at that same time, 85, 86. And then went from there back into the book trade, managing actually someone else's business, the Polynesian Bookshop, which was a fantastic bookshop in Auckland. But then got recruited by the New Zealand AIDS Foundation because they said, look, we've got this kind of a job. And at the beginning it was, you know, at the beginning it was kind of voluntary and maybe a little bit of money. But it was, we need a gay man with some political skills to work in this anti-discrimination campaign. And so that's what I went and did. So I gave up my paid work, went and worked for the AIDS Foundation. It did become a paid job over time. I did 5 years there and secured world-leading anti-discrimination legislation. And then from there sort of had got interested in the health sector and moved on into other health roles and kind of a leading figure in parts of the health sector. I chaired the Public Health Advisory Committee and was part of the National Health Committee. It went back after that into the AIDS Foundation again as executive director during part of that time being a consultant on health projects and actually owning my own bookshop, disastrously owning my own music shop. Turns out that's not a good kind of business to get into. and then found my way actually back onto the West Coast or back into the health sector as the chief executive of the West Coast District Health Board. So I've kind of had these intertwining careers as this sort of voluntary community activist on political issues, this business career in the bookselling sector, and this health sector career. And all of the time, I don't think I've ever taken a job that was about the money, for example, or about prestige or status. It's all about how can I, you know, how can I help meet my ethical duties through this job. So the health sector, it's pretty clear. You know, I've been an activist for political change, the theory of health promotion that I'm expert in. It basically says people's health status is a function of their empowerment and the physical, social, and economic environments that they live in. If you want to improve people's health, you have to change those environments, and you have to empower people, empower their communities. So that's fundamentally a political model of improving people's health, which I have brought to all of my health positions at the AIDS Foundation. That's kind of the model that we worked on. And in the West Coast District Health Board, that's the model that we worked on.
Had you graduated now with student debt and the wages that we're encountering in the job market that most graduates walk into now, do you think you could have done the same thing?
No, I couldn't have done. I think, you know, it's one of the themes that I've been taking up is intergenerational equity. I had the opportunity. I did that first degree in sciences. I then, out of sheer interest, then studied Scandinavian studies. So, you know, I learnt Swedish and studied Scandinavian literature and culture at university for 3 years. Well, I certainly couldn't have afforded to do that, and yet that enormously enriched my outlook on the world. Went on and did a diploma in public health, and you know, my student debt after that lot would exceed $100,000. Well, you know, you couldn't follow my career path, which is give up the paid work and go and work on the streets or in a community based organisation for years on end with that sort of student debt. You know, I think we are. I mean, the thing that I say about, you know, student loans is we need to recognise that the lion's share of the benefit that comes out of a person's education at tertiary level is public good. It's not the personal benefit that they derive. And that's why the public should be paying for that.
Do you think it's a coincidence that as student debt is laid on to students, that student activism plummets? Because I remember as a student, no fees, and basically we went to protests all the time, was something you did as a student. I've never seen a student protest here, well, once, I think.
Yeah. Yes, it's a little bit of a leading question, Shane, but I'm happy to go where the question leads, because I think it's right, you know. And at the time that I was involved in student politics, so late 70s, early 80s, and then I had another stint actually sort of back in late 80s, early 90s actually. But we were the process of being at university was, you know, it was about sort of learning and acquiring a degree, but it was also about engaging in the issues of the day, actually becoming an active participant in the society and stakeholder in the process of government. And I think you could look at student movements and the contribution of students to social change movements in New Zealand as part of the conscience of the society, in fact. You know, that universities like to think of themselves as consciences of a society in some ways. And I think we've lost an awful lot of that function through this financial shackle that we put around students' ankles.
So I suppose that neatly kind of encapsulates that idea of what's the connection to society and economy, that you can, you know, put a clamp on society by putting economic shackles on people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, it clearly suits the neoliberal establishment to silence its critics. And you know, this is one of the mechanisms that it uses. I mean, it's not the only one.
So what would you say about, for instance, working people's engagement with politics in New Zealand? I mean, is there a connection between the lowering wages and opportunities in life and their ability or desire to engage with society?
Yeah. I remember an early conversation as I was learning about health promotion, which was about, well, why are Māori women the last significant demographic in New Zealand to give up smoking? Well, actually, it's because their lives are subject to so many pressures that their personal health is kind of at the bottom of the list. And I think, you know, we have a situation where sort of wages and working conditions and living conditions have been driven down so far that it is much harder for people to find the space in their lives to actually engage with political process. And I think that the preeminence of the economy and its treatment as if it were, you know, the point of society is so powerful that consumerism has been such a powerful force that people believe that their primary relationship is with the economy and not with their fellow members of society. So consumerism has atomized and disempowered people, and that's no accident. You know, it absolutely serves the interests of the neoliberal establishment.
Okay, let's carry on with your revolutionary journey, but quite quickly, because at least one of us is looking at the time. How did you get to become a Green MP?
Well, as you might know, and as listeners might know, as a chief executive of a district health board, I was a senior public servant, and senior public servants are not allowed to be politically involved. But of course, with my background, and you know, we've covered a little bit of that. I mean, but sort of anti-apartheid, there's also the Pākehā Treaty movement and Men Against Sexism and the environment movement and gay rights. All of that, I had been pretty heavily involved in politics and in the politics of progressive change. So the Green Party had come along during the time that I'd been essentially required not to be involved in politics. So I was very strongly aligned with the Green Party's policies, and I had been thinking about, well, is there something that I can add? And I'd come to the conclusion that yes, there was, that I had a set of skills from the background that I had that would be pretty useful to the Green Party. And people in the Green Party that I'd been speaking to agreed with that and were hopeful that I would become available. So for me, it was the question of when did I jump, because I had to leave my job with the District Health Board in order to try and become a Green Party MP. So the risk here was quite high. but the thing that tipped the scales for me was climate change. You know, I believed that the urgency to act around climate change was such that if I felt that I could add something, that the duty that I had was to take that risk, that I'd end up without a job and give it a go. And I haven't regretted the choice that I made, although I have to say at this point I haven't yet made much of a difference on climate change. I'm hoping that if I'm successful with this co-leadership race that I will be in a position to change that.
What successes have you had in the last couple of years?
Well, the things that I point to as successes are things like marriage equality, you know, where I worked with Lewis of Wall and I did the backroom strategy stuff, working across the Parliament and across the sort of community parliament divide to put together the coalition and the plan to take that bill and move it very quickly into law. So that was one of them. I was very proud of that. I'm also particularly proud of the change around occupational health and safety, and we've talked a little bit about the impact of deregulation of occupational health and safety measured directly for me by those 29 men's lives, some of whom were people I knew. But I know that as a result of the changed law and regulation that has come about as a result of me working with the minister, that working lives are now considerably safer than they were before I was on the scene. Similarly with ACC, you know, ACC had what I call a culture of disempowerment, where it had moved from trying to meet the needs of the person standing in front of them to how can I say no to you? How can I deny your claim or minimize the service that we provide? I believe that while it's not completely turned around, we have made the fundamental difference that will see that culture move back to the public service culture it needs to be.
Okay, some questions to end with quite quickly, if you don't mind. You talked about having intertwined careers, one of which was an activist. So do you consider yourself to be an activist now?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't think of myself as an activist. I see myself as – I mean, I see the Green Party in Parliament as kind of the parliamentary wing of a bigger movement for progressive environmental and social change. So that's the job that I have now. I don't go out and organise demonstrations. I do develop strategy. I do participate in partnership with community-based organisations that very definitely are activists. And I'm absolutely proud of that record of activism, of all of the convictions that I have for all of those protest-related activities, badges of honour in my view.
What motivates you now?
The same things. I'm motivated by the same things that have motivated me all of the time. Social justice is my obligation to. I don't see how anyone actually can be satisfied with their own life, knowing that so many people do not have the same opportunities that they have, knowing that so many people live in injustice and poverty. I don't see how anyone can be happy with their life knowing that we have this unsustainable relationship with the environment that condemns future generations, which are our kids and our grandkids, to a poorer life than we have now.
What challenges do you have in the next couple of years?
Well, the big challenge for me, of course, and I'm hopeful that I'm successful in becoming the co-leader of this great party of ours, the big challenge for me is to enter government and then implement Green Party policy in a way that sets the platform for bigger and more progressive change as time goes by. We need to be a government not only for the next 3 years from 2017, but for years to come after that, because it's not a small change we need to make in this country. It's a massive transformational change, and that requires the Green Party on the scene for a long time to come.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur before you wake up tomorrow morning, what would it be?
I guess a reversal of fortunes, that the last what's it been since September last year, 6 months, we're all a really bad dream. We step out of the shower, it's over, and actually we won. We're in government. That would be fantastic. If I had the magic wand, that would be it.
If you could be Prime Minister, what would you do? What's top priority for you?
Well, I guess I haven't been thinking about that, but fundamentally the top priority has got to be to engage a bigger consensus of citizens in this process of change. So it could be something actually a little bit off beam. It could be public broadcasting, you know, a return to a public broadcasting function that directly makes that connection between citizens and the process of government and the ownership of this country. That's the kind of thing that might be an important enabling factor right on the ground floor.
And lastly, do you have any advice for listeners?
Vote Green would be the single biggest piece of advice. I'm going to think, well, actually, really, the biggest piece of advice is please engage in this process. Please engage in the process of taking back ownership of our country and of our democracy. We need you. We need you to demand the citizenship rights that you are owed.
That's fantastic. We have to wrap it up there. You're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM. This has been the show for the 9th of April, 2015. Our guest tonight was Kevin Haig. Your hosts were Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe on iTunes or on oir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.